Oh. Thank you. Okay, deep breaths now, everyone, because we're all going to sing along and we're going to play it again. Anaphora by Michael Edward Edgerton.
I wondered if your singer brought any new sounds to the recording, or were they already conceived for her?
This is an interesting point, because first, to answer your question, no. She hadn't sung contemporary music before I started working with her. So everything there, I've taught her, because I was first a vocalist, and I did a lot of experimental stuff as a vocalist. So so yes, I taught her all that stuff. But this is the interesting point, that to do this kind of stuff, I mean, I don't know how much you guys are doing with this kind of stuff, but I can't give the music to somebody and just say, hey, can you do this piece? You know, oh, well, what's the range? You know, it's completely irrelevant to this piece. What I have to do is I have to, like, work with them very intensely in order, with sound production. And you know, what to do with their breath, where to place it, what, I mean, the tension of the vocal folds. I mean, it's a very intensive process in developing this kind of stuff. It's completely different than working with classical voice.
And we should mention the title of the book is The 21st Century Voice. It's from Scarecrow Press, and it has received some very good reviews, and it also is considered sort of the definitive work on this process. And any composers listening who have written for extended voice need to get their hands on a copy of this book.
Thanks.
It also talks about not only the methods, but also sort of safety.
Yeah. That's important.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because we've just heard 20 plus minutes of what sounds like an awful beating on the old voice. How do you keep the voice safe?
By always keeping in mind good vocal health. Part of the let me see, how can I phrase this best? With many classical voice teachers, they make a wrong assumption. No. Some voice teachers make the wrong assumption that vocal behaviors that are outside of the classical, voice type production methods are damaging to the voice. But
they will say straight out, "This is going to hurt your voice. Don't do it."
Yeah, and they're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
It may be that an opera singer would not want to do this if they want to be an opera singer, but that, I think, has more to do with style and a certain technique rather than damaging the voice, because those are two different issues. Performing in a particular style, I mean, how many opera singers do you know can sing like Mick Jagger? Now, of course, they wouldn't want to, for the most part, but the point is that I'm not claiming that Mick Jagger has good technique or a healthy physiology. He might, he may not. I really don't listen to that kind of music, but much.
Yeah, but it's influenced you so much. No. Just silence on the. I got silence on that one. He didn't know if I was serious.
He's getting a Finnish sense of humor, I'm afraid.
That's right. Too much Kaisari Aho around him. Okay, then.
No!
Right. But I understand. It's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the people that do Broadway shows are not the people who do opera, even though they both have issues of projection they have to deal with and range and the ability to be durable as well.
Yeah. I mean, who said that a Tibetan monk has bad technique, but yet he wouldn't think of singing opera? But, you know, these cats sing until they're 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same with these guys who, a little bit farther to the north and to the east, you know, they ride bareback on the horses and, you know, they sing at the top of their lungs for their whole lives, you know, these two-man throat singers.
Right.
And, you know, so what's the evidence of vocal violence? You know, what's the evidence of hurting your voice if they can do that into old age? And they're happy with the voice, so it's a difference in technique, I think. But it's wrong to say that's going to hurt the voice. That's a different issue. It's a difference of technique that voice teachers who are wanting their students to become classical opera divas. That's what they really mean. It's a change of technique. It's not necessarily going to hurt the voice, because singing Schubert can hurt you as much as trying to sing overtones, or doing what Angie did in Anaphora, who, by the way, mm-hmm. is a classically trained opera singer, and she sings professionally in Berlin as a classical opera singer. So, you know.
You can make the transition in both directions. There are some people who are quite good at producing a multiplicity of not only sounds but styles.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, of course, Joan LaBarbera comes to mind. She has her own catalog.
Yeah.
And how she works, very sort of around kind of a sound in her work.
Right. Yeah, and you know, in terms of technique and this issue of vocal violence, you know, an important thing is to really watch the tension that somebody is placing on the vocal folds and trying to figure out how to avoid excessive tension. And if you choose to use tension, then to make sure that the singer absolutely recognizes when they are using it and to make sure that they don't use it for long. But this is no different than classical singing. Anyhow,
let's hear something else. We could either continue this sort of thread with Marriage Shadows, and I don't have any background on that because I couldn't find that in your works list.
Sorry.
or we can go to the string quartet, which is good now.
Marriage of Shadows. I sent over a bunch of excerpts, huh? And
right, you did.
Yeah, and this was a piece that was commissioned by. This is placed actually by an American living in England, who's directing a place called the Institute for Digital Innovation, and it's a new kind of a research initiative at the University of Teesside in North England, and in England they have something called the AV Fest, which is supposedly the UK's largest festival of new media, experimental art, blah 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 blah. And so he wanted to commission me for this festival.
Can you say the name?
Oh, the AV Fest.
No, the person who commissioned.
Oh, sorry, Jim Turkhoust. He's actually, as a child, he spent time in Wisconsin, oddly enough.
Oh, well, see, this gets around.
Although I didn't know him then. I met him up in Scotland when I was doing a residency up there. And so this was performed and written for the ensemble Ars Nova, which this guitarist, Stefan, is the director. And Angie, who you just heard,
That's Angela Radema.
Yeah, is the singer. And it has to do with, you know, loosely the concepts of innovation, and so I developed things around those notions. But maybe that's a good piece to hear. I don't know.
Yeah, let's hear it. This is, I'm just queuing it up here. This is Marriage of Shadows by our guest today on Calvus and Damien in the House, Michael Edward Edgerton. That's were six excerpts from Marriage of Shadows by Michael Edward Edgerton. What kind of instrumentation is that throughout? A little bit more background on who, what's being played there.
Yeah. So it's a flute, an alto flute. Sounds funny to say that, doesn't it? Alto sax and tenor sax. And let me see, percussion, whole lot of different things. Oh, which I've changed the sound of the vibraphone since that recording, because it was, this was kind of a rush commission and I didn't really have time to finish the piece. And so the sound, the vibraphone was kind of forced on me because it's a very long story, but in the end I had to use the vibraphone. And so I've never liked that 60s sound, and so it really bothered me in performance, the sound of, I don't know, of the vibe. So what I've just done is I was able to find a vibraphone in a place that's about 50-60 kilometers from here, music school, and I was working with that, and I placed huge metal bars on top of the vibe itself, and changed the opening of the sound.
Oh, I bet they really liked that you did that.
Oh, they love it, yeah.
Very touchy about their mallet instruments, I think.
Yeah, they never do. And then the other thing I did was I made kind of like a tinfoil boat and put some like little pieces of metal inside and I put them right on top of that felt pad that's right in the middle of the black and white keys on the vibraphone. And it has like this really amazing little ringing sound, and so I'm going to use both of those methods in our next performances of this piece. So
the orchestration of this kind of will lead us into I think the string quartet,
yeah.
because here's another example of I've seen the score excerpts of this as well, of an incredibly complex score. Now, would you please kind of describe what the players read? You know, describe it not only for lay people but for musicians so that we all get a perspective. I mean, they certainly can go to your website and see some images of this. Maybe you could give a kind of an overview of what the performers kind of have to do.
Yeah, well, this is also similar to what I do with the voice and also with wind instruments, but basically what the performer sees are multiple staves, and they may be, so you have the main five stave with pitch and rhythm normally notated, then you have other staves that could range from four lines to, well, I guess more, down to one line staves. And those different staves indicate other sound production behaviors. So, for instance, with bow speed, and when you're playing a piece normally, with the right and left hand kind of, you know, moving along according to the tempo and the meter, as indicated, it's possible to kind of desynchronize, for instance, different elements when producing a sound. And with the string instruments, with bowed string instruments, there may be up to, I don't know, 13 or so different elements that are used in producing a normal sound. And it's possible to desynchronize the most prominent elements involved in that sound production. So, for instance, the speed of a bow. If you're bowing, for instance, quarter notes, quarter note equals 60, the right hand is normally at a ratio of 1:1 or 2:1 or 1:2 with what the left hand is doing. So normally there's kind of a whole number ratio with between the right and left hand. But it's possible to pull that left and right hand apart from each other. And so, for instance, the easiest case would be, for instance, if you're bowing a scale up and down, each note lasting a quarter note at quarter note equals 60. And the right hand begins bowing at the slowest possible speed, let's say 1 minute on a bow, three quarters of a bow, or maybe even a full bow. And in the time that it takes to go one octave up and then back down again, you would go from the very slowest possible speed with the right hand to the very fastest speed with the right hand. So much so that the bow begins to fly off the strings and bounce and and about to, you know, spear the fish as it's jumping out of the water. And this Finnish lake.
Wisconsin again. Oh, Finnish. Finland and Wisconsin. All right.
So, for instance, it's the idea is that, and you know, James Tenney talked about this back in the 60s, any element you can use to change the sound may be, depending on one's imagination as a composer or a listener or a performer, you know, can be valid basis for a composition. Right, and any element that changes the sound, then you can use that. And so, through desynchronizing one or more of these elements, either singly or simultaneously with one another, then you have the potential for changing sounds. And this has to do with not only acoustics and instrument design, but also perception. And so I've done also formalized research on both the acoustics and perception of this kind of desynchronized behavior, in order that we can continue to explore sound production and composition with these instruments, because it's my feeling that not everything has been explored with instruments still.
That's true, and it sort of brings up a question that Damien and I were both talking about before the interview, and that's the sort of era of experimentation that we recall includes so much of the kind of alternative sounds that there's almost a retrospective feel about some of these pieces, like they belong to another time. Is that just kind of a bias that has come because experimentalism, if you will take that as a kind of a representative of a period from, say, 1950 to 1970-ish, has been dumped on so heavily by the kind of a harmonic notey era that we have today?
Well, I think a couple of different things regarding that. I think one that regarding criticism of explorative, the explorative desire in terms of an artwork looking towards something unseen or untested rather than, you know, looking backwards. Well, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, we can always look backwards, or we can, you know, look at our own navel our whole lives. But, you know, it's not a bad thing to try to look at something unseen. So that's what I'd say about that. But the point about thinking about sound production again, there's a crucial difference here with not only what I'm doing, but there are other folks who are. I think it's more prevalent over here in Europe than in the States these days. I could be wrong, but...
Oh, no, I think you're absolutely right, yes.
Yeah, and the crucial difference for me is that one reason why the extended technique movement fell out of favor was because people got tired of the tricks not having a musical... robustness that the main elements of pitch and rhythm and slightly to a less degree timbre had. And what I mean by that is that with pitch and rhythm, you can scale a pitch from a very low pitch to a very high pitch. Right, and of course you could do all sorts of alterations in terms of spectralism or you know, different tunings and things like this, or different temperaments. And the same with rhythm. You can scale from a very small temporal unit to a very large temporal unit. With extended techniques, what happened was that they became a series of unscalable sounds that were just kind of like these, you know, these effects that people threw onto something in order to make some sort of political, social, you know, a societal, some sort of musical statement, right? It was a reactionary statement. What people are doing today, and what I've seen in the last, I don't know, maybe the last 10 years or less, is that people are taking that concept of scaling from a very minimal value to a very maximal value and applying that to the different elements involved in sound production. So, if we take a string and we say, okay, there are 13 different elements that can be desynchronized either singly or with other elements, and we apply this concept of scalability to any one parameter, any one element, I should say, rather than parameter. So bow speed, we can notate from a very slow bow speed, very slow as possible bow speed, to a very fast bow speed. And we can use any number of ways of notating that, but it's this crucial element of scaling so that it can be reminiscent of somebody like Chelsea, where you could have a single note, right?
Mm-hmm.
and you know, you finger a B natural, a major seventh above middle C, the whole piece can be designed around, for instance, I mean, this is really kind of a simple kind of brainless example, but you can write a whole piece around this concept of just the speed of the bow, and just with that one element, you can develop a piece that has quite a bit of variation. So this, of course, is a simple example and would sound like kind of an old experiment, but from probably the 60s. But it's this crucial aspect for me of scaling all the different elements involved in sound production, similar to how you would scale rhythm or pitch. In this case, I don't think the pieces will sound... well, at a certain level, it's going to sound like music. It's going to sound like unusual sounds, and people were doing unusual sounds for the last 40 years. So I guess in that sense, you know, an unusual sound is an unusual sound. But then, you know, what do we do with electronic music or electroacoustic music? Or so?
Okay, then that's good. I think we wanted to address that because hearing the kind of techniques and philosophy and approach and experimentalism all kind of loaded up into one sounds like a very sort of scary thing. Now we're going to hear the actual piece, and we're going to say, oh, I hope we're going to say, oh, that works.
Oh, but I should...
Anyway.
Oh, no.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I should say that in the performance you have, I think it's just the ending of the piece, right, from 11.
Yes, it
yeah.
is. It's yeah.
Yeah. I should say that the string quartet who did this did not do all of the elements that were asked of them. Is that a good way to say that?
Well, all right, that's okay, you know, as long as we don't name the string quartet. Come on, tell us, come on, tell us.
It was, should I say or what?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, well, it was the Cairo String Quartet.
Those guys. You'd figure.
Yeah.
We could have said that anyway, because it does say it right on the title.
That's right, yeah.
Anyway, let's hear it. Michael Edward Edgerton is our guest here on Calvos and Damien in the house. And we're going to hear... does this have a name, this string quartet, other than string quartet number one?
That's it, man. Yeah, and it's in five movements, so that's only the first one.
We're just going to hear a part of this piece, and I think what you've told us is very well kind of summarized in this, even if they didn't make it all. So let's hear it.